Actually, Gulstrom was a 14th best OBP hitter in the NL with the injury last year. You know, so he good, as people say.
Good evening, and welcome to episode 47 of Flags Fly Forever, Baseball Prospectus Fantasy Podcast. I am your host, Brett Sayer, and with me, as always, is Mike Gianella and Mauricio Rubio. How are you guys doing after our brief hiatus?
I just want to say that we took a trip out to Arizona, which was lovely, and then after the weather had broken a little bit here in Chicago, it snowed today, 5 inches.
Yeah, that sucks.
Yeah, it was bad. Very bad. So no fruit for me. None. No fruit talk.
No.
No, that kind of weather.
Oh, well. How about you, Mike? I got to see Mike this weekend. That was exciting. I got to see both of them separately, but Mal, I got to see you a week and a half ago, and Mike, I got to see you this weekend. So good weekend for the BP team.
And I was talking to Mal, you know, I'm going out on the BP Milwaukee trip, try saying that three times fast, in early May. So I'll be seeing Mal in like about a month and a half. So we're all getting together.
Yeah. You guys have met, right?
DC. Yeah, we met in DC.
Yeah. Yeah. DC. Okay.
Yeah, we laughed, we cried. You missed the thing at the bar with the weird older German dude, which I've shared that story before.
I did, yeah. I'm sad that I missed the German dude.
Also, Mike is very tall. I don't know if our listeners know that, but Mike is a very, very tall human being.
Yet, at Tout Wars, you know, as Brett will point out, that I don't know why, but the fantasy community is like a weird subset of tall people. Like, it's one of those few places in life where I'm like, oh, like, I'm kind of above average here. I'm not super tall.
It's very strange, and even like the non-super tall people are still pretty tall.
Yeah, like, and then you got Mike Podhurst, who, you know, is like a sprite. If you're listening, Mike, I'm sorry. I love you, but you are very short.
Yeah, Mike's like one of the few people that's my height.
I think he's shorter than you, actually.
I don't know. I don't think he is. I don't know. We'll have to find out. I'll ask him.
Are we going to have like a fantasy combine or something? Like, just going to take measurements?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it would be really sad to see everyone's verticals, though.
No, I don't think we have to do that. Don't think we have to do that.
This is getting real weird real fast.
It is. as many of you can tell, and this is what we're going to spend literally the entire episode on, we have just finished with the Tout Wars weekend. Mike was in town for the whole thing, participated in the NL auction. I was in town on Saturday, and I was in Tout Wars X, the experimental league. So we're going to talk about each of our experiences and sort of how things went according to plan, not according to plan, and some interesting things that we saw. And then we're going to touch on the remainder of the auctions over the weekend, and that's going to be it. So if you don't want to hear about Tout Wars, then we'll see you next week. But there's a lot of really good stuff to talk about. So let's get the pleasantries out of the way. You can read all of us at baseballprospectus.com. You can find us on Twitter. I am at Dynasty Guru. Mike is at Mike Gianella. That's Gianella. Mal is at MRubio52. You can reach us as a collective podcast at Flags Fly Forever at baseballprospectus.com. And we ask that you rate and review us on iTunes and the Stitcher radio app. So we decided that we're gonna kick off with mine, with Tout X, and I'm going to kind of talk through what the format was, and it's very different from the rest of the auctions. That's for sure. And then I am going to kind of throw it around and see what you guys think of the format first, and then we'll get into how the draft actually played out. So this is let me take a step back. ToutX is designed to have a different experimental format every year. So this year we're using sort of the standard Chandler Park format, monthly fantasy. So obviously this was the baby of Ron Chandler, who is one of the benefactors of Tout. And he certainly put together an interesting format. And there were 10 of us drafting teams of 32, 23 active players, 9 reserve. And it's a monthly. I'll try to explain this as best I can. It's a little difficult to explain because it's a lot to take in, because it's quite different than the regular auction. It's a 4x4 league. The offensive categories are home runs, stolen bases, on base percentage, and runs produced, which is runs plus RBI minus home runs. And then from a pitching standpoint, you have ERA, strikeouts, saves plus holds, and wins plus quality starts. So the budget for the teams was $300. You could spend it on your 32 roster spots. And every player we selected had a fixed salary that was listed on ChandlerPark.com. So we went around and did a snake draft of players at their given values. So that's the setup. It's two catchers. It's pretty much exactly the breakdown as you would expect from a 23-man active roster. So with that, let's just talk format for a second. Mike, What did you think of the format when you first saw it? Is this were you familiar with the monthly game that Ron puts on, or was this as foreign to you as it was to me?
I was aware of the game because last year Ron was advertising it. It was the inauguration of the game at Chandler Park. And other people, notably Phil Hertz of Baseball HQ, who is in the Tout NL, had emailed about it. He had kind of promoted it and talked about it. So I was aware of it, but really all I kind of knew about it was that it was a monthly game, and I knew some of the strategies. I went to First Pitch HQ early March as a presenter, and Ron talked about it there, so I had a broad idea of it, but I really did not know a lot of the intricacies that you just mentioned. So had I been invited to Tout Wars X, I would have been probably just as much in the dark as many of the participants were. And I think you were too, Brett. I think from when we talked beforehand, you certainly, you know, had a strategy, but you were kind of like, gee, you know, I really don't know how it's going to work out because I've never done anything like this before.
Yeah, I wanted to I wanted to go in with a completely blank slate. I know there's a lot of strategy content on ChandlerPark.com, and I know people who have done it, but I went in having not read any of it. I wanted to kind of look at the rules and digest them and just do what came to mind in looking at the rules. And as we'll talk about, I had a very distinct strategy, and I think I was the only person with that strategy. So we'll see if it gave me either an advantage or a disadvantage. I mean, the fun thing about this is that I honestly have no idea right now. Once the first month is over, we'll have a better idea. But Mal, you have any thoughts on the format before we dive into my strategy and my team?
Yeah, no, I was only tangentially aware of it. I think Mike showed it to me last year, so I knew that it existed. But this is, reading about it, it's a different type of a format, and it's kind of made looking at these teams a little different. And I think outlining your strategy and kind of outlining your team is going to really highlight a lot of the differences between this and just standard 5x5 roto. So, I mean, obviously OBP is a big difference. Some of the stats are a little different, but I think the way that you attacked this is it's going to be illuminating. So, the floor is yours.
Yeah. So this was my strategy, and my first thought was this: that I didn't want to pay the prices that people were going to be paying for closers and setup men. You never know how many other people are going to be playing, and the values just seemed to not work out. And that, plus the fact that there were two starting pitcher counting categories out of four, and then the other one is ERA, which is obviously, you know, it's hard enough to project for a full season, let alone for 4 weeks. So my plan was to completely punt relievers. I was going to grab a couple of hopefully multi-eligibility bats for my bench, and then literally load up on starting pitchers. I went in with the target number of 15, and I hit it. I took 15 starting pitchers. And that way, I figure even with all the off days in April, we're allowed to change our lineups twice a week. So I should have 9 starts every time I set my lineup, which means that even if my pitching stinks, I should still win wins plus quality starts and strikeouts. So from there, that's how I knew I wanted to tackle pitching. And because I knew I could do that without really worrying too much about which pitchers I took, the second part of my strategy was to fill my entire offense before I took a single pitcher. It seems crazy, but We'll get into it, and I'll kind of talk through why I took some of the pitchers when I did, and who was left at the end. I also wanted to go in with an open mind, grabbing values first, and then seeing how other teams were spending their money, and if other teams were spending money at a pace a bit quicker than me, I was going to ramp up my value selections, and then use the use sort of the big stack to grab essentially whoever's left. I figured with the prices and the fact that it was a 10-team league, there would be enough left that I'd have real players to choose from, and that is exactly what happened. So my offense, I knew which players my first two targets were going to be, and I got both of them. My first round pick, I had the fourth pick overall, and I took Chris Davis because his price was $11. And, you know, the prices, you know, comparatively, they're somewhat similar to what you would expect roto prices to be. You know, the most expensive guys Kershaw was 40. I think Mike Trout was 41. Andrew McCutchen was 39. So you kind of get the idea from there. Chris Davis at 11 in OBP league is insane value. From there, I took Manny Machado second, who was $7. And part of the reason for the Orioles is that actually Ron did send out a very nifty spreadsheet ahead of time to show where the home away splits and pitcher splits were over the course of the first cycle. And Baltimore plays like 2/3 of their games at home. And Camden Yards offense, yay! So I did that, and then I just kept picking offensive players and picking offensive players until I had one middle infield spot left, and then I took about 10 pitchers in a row. So instead of naming off my whole roster, Mike, you were there for, you know, in and out for part of the draft. How, you know, what were your impressions as a spectator And did the draft go sort of about how you would have thought, or is it was it just a kind of complete crapshoot for everybody?
I thought it was, well, I have a few observations as an outsider. I think for one, because I didn't do the prep and because this wasn't a typical auction or draft, I honestly didn't have a good idea of what was going on. And I was as confused at first as some people who were like, oh, like, why would Brett take, you know, Chris Davis, you know, putting the price aside? It just seems that you would take some better players first and then go, you know, go later for players that aren't as good. You know, Davis was in the second tier. I didn't realize until watching the first few rounds that, you know, it was definitely a value game. And it was kind of like an auction in the sense that it was almost a mix of an auction and a draft. It was an auction in the sense that you had prices assigned to players, you're trying to get bargains. And it was a draft in the sense that you were the one calling out the players instead of it being dictated by bidding. So I it was almost like the topper rule, which some auction leagues use, where you know the bidding stops, you can go plus one. It was like a topper on every pick, and I found that really interesting. And it probably wasn't until five or six rounds in that the strategies of people, and I think some people really didn't have strategies, became evident. So it really took a while as a spectator to get a feel. And I don't know if as a participant, if that was the case too, because as I said, I don't want to mention anybody on the show and call them out. I think some of the participants, you could tell they were kind of struggling a little bit with the format as it went along.
Yeah, it was definitely interesting because, you know, you could take a look at, you know, the guys that I took at the beginning. And then you'd expect, oh, but, you know, you took Chris Davis and Manny Machado in the first two rounds. You know, your offense probably has some holes in it. But just to give an example of sort of where these guys went, my third round pick was Justin Upton, and that, you know, that pretty much ties in with Roto Value where he was being taken. But this is my full offense that was drafted. I had Yadi Molina and Yan Gomes at catcher, Chris Davis, Manny Machado, Joey Votto, Aaron Hill, Xander Bogaerts, Brian Dozier, Ryan Braun, Justin Upton, Curtis Granderson, Billy Hamilton, Jock Peterson, and Albert Pujols. So if you had money, there were players to buy, and the different players came out at strange times, and there were some teams that were clearly going for values early. Some teams were just clearly going for best player available at certain points, and it really ended up with a lot of people putting together a lot of different looking teams. You know, I'm very happy with how my offense turned out. I think. Well, essentially, with punting one category in a 4x4, I need to pretty much kill it on offense. Out of 40 possible points, my goal is to get 35, and I think I put myself in a position where it's possible. So we'll see how that turns out. But the pitching is where this got really interesting, and as we got through the draft. It was easy to spot that there were some substantial starting pitchers that were hanging out still available as people were starting to run out of money, and it was very noticeable that I was going to get at least a couple of them. It was really we took a break after I think maybe 20 players had been taken. Really, everyone was down in the $40 to $60 range, except me and Pat Mayo, and we did exactly what you would expect. We used the last 12 rounds or so to throw the rest of our money around and get the best players that were left. So, my reserve pitching staff. Is way better than my starting pitching staff as I drafted it, but that was by design. The goal was to get the values in pitching early and then pony up for whoever was left. So I guess I'll read this off, and be curious to get your guys' thoughts on either some of the individual pitchers or just how it worked out in general. The first nine pitchers I took were Kyle Hendricks, Jose Quintana, Brandon McCarthy, Danny Duffy, TJ House, Jaime Garcia, R.A. Dickey, Dan Haran, and Bartolo Colon. And that was all for a sum of $36. So that was the value play. And then with all the leftover money, these are my bench starters. And I use scare quotes here. Jordan Zimmerman, Raisel Iglesias, John Lester, Gio Gonzalez, CJ Wilson, and Jared Weaver. So those were the guys that were left, and there were more players left too. Nobody took Chris Sale. Chris Sale was $27, and he's only going to get probably two starts in this time period. But even from an offensive standpoint, no one took Michael Brantley, who was priced at $30. No one took Brett Gardner. No one took Shin-Soo Choo. I think there was one other big name hitter that did not get taken, but those are the ones that are coming to mind now.
I think wasn't it Michael Brantley?
Yeah. Brantley was the first guy. But
it made
for such a fascinating dynamic, because at some point, me and Pat and I were the only two people left who could have bought Brantley, and we were kind of staring each other out just to see if one of us was going to do it, and. That was when I took Zimmerman, so that knocked me out of the running for him, and he decided to go elsewhere as well. But it worked out that, it not only worked out that there were sort of top shelf pitchers available later, but it worked out really nicely because there are top shelf pitchers left that I really like. I mean, listeners know that I love Jordan Zimmerman. I like John Lester about on par as everyone else. I wouldn't say I'm higher or lower on him than the crowd. But Zimmerman and Gio Gonzalez for a combined $33, I thought was excellent. And then the other thing I wanted to do was fill my bench with players who had more extreme home road situations. So hence Jared Weaver and CJ Wilson. I have Travis Snyder on my bench for the outfield, so I can plug him in over. I can plug him in when the Orioles are playing at home against predominantly right-handed starters. And then I got Steven Vogt, who should pick up catcher eligibility within the first week or week and a half of gameplay. And should give me an option at a couple different positions should anyone go down with an injury. So that's a lot of me talking. So Mal, knowing what you know about the format and knowing the team that I have, where do you think my strength and my weakness is?
I am going to make a quick observation, but it's pretty clear who your crushes are, pitching wise. You've been pretty loyal to Jaime Garcia, where I think everybody else has kind of abandoned him.
Oh, I love Jaime.
You know, I think a lot of your main strengths are, oddly enough, pitching wise, the kind of the stats that you're throwing out there is strong. Top to bottom. You know, when you're going Jordan Zimmerman, John Lester, and Gio Gonzalez as your reserve starters, like that's just that sound decision making, and I think that's something that you did pretty well. Middle infield, I'm not necessarily in love with the situation that you have there, which is, it's nitpicking. I'm on the Aaron Hill train because you guys have, talked about him for a long time, and I guess you're just starting to rub off on me. But so it's, I get that. Xander, I still think long-term he's going to be a great player, but, given the format and the short window that we're talking about here, at $5, it doesn't really matter all that much, right? But, you know, I think that has the potential to be a weakness if he doesn't get out of the gate very strong. But I mean, other than that, like, this is a pretty competent team. Like, this is you know, when you kind of look at it top to bottom, compared to the other teams and kind of what everybody else did, you know, the two catches that you have are strong. The offense top to bottom is strong. And I mean, pitching wise, you can just kind of do whatever. I mean, clearly and intentionally so, your relievers aren't anything. you don't have a reliever.
they're mostly invisible.
Yes, they're they're non-existent. But so yeah, I mean, I just think, you know, maybe your ratios hurt a little bit, and you're clearly not going to win saves and holds. But no, this is a good team.
Thanks.
Yeah, I really like it. I have to say I'm not in any leagues with Brett, and I'm kind of glad I'm not after looking at this, because I think you took a format that none of us have ever played and seemed kind of challenging and did very well with it right off the bat. I mean, in particular, what jumps out at me to not, you know, retouch on the points that Mao touched on, the OBP guys you got, like Dozier. You know, Justin Upton's kind of a sneaky OBP guy. Curtis Granderson is a hell of an OBP guy. There's just a lot of value here in those kind of picks. And again, you know, yeah, you lose a little bit with the relievers, but with all those starters there, there's so many potential streaming options. And the nice thing about the replacement format, as you mentioned, it kind of gives you a chance to kind of plug and play a lot, which I think some other owners in this league don't have. So your team really looks terrific, and I think that other people in this league are going to have some trouble against you in the first month.
Thanks. So yeah, it's a, you know, obviously it's we'll see how this goes. I'm hopeful that I'll get off to a good start in the first month, and then in subsequent months in this league, teams are selected via what you would generally expect from a salary cap league. So there's not a draft; everyone just picks their own salary cap team. So people can overlap in future months, different players, whereas they could not in the first month since we did the in-person draft. So yeah, that's pretty much it for this draft. You know,
can I just want to point out before we leave this, if this sounds interesting to you, go to ChandlerParkAllOneWord.com and check it out. I mean, I think that the whole idea of this, and I kind of agree, it's a compromise between daily games, which kind of have a random feel to it, and the year-long commitment of fantasy. Like, if you're kind of in the middle, it's kind of a good thing. And honestly, if you're in one league and you're tanking in June or July and you're kind of bored and you've dumped already, it's not a bad game to get into either.
I completely agree, and we'll absolutely talk about it over the course of the season as we to another league to our stable that we'll talk about through the year. So it'll be definitely be a change of pace conversation from when we talk about our labor team or Mike's Tout team.
I can hear Mao smiling on his end of the line.
or drinking.
I'm drinking and I'm smiling because I am drinking.
That makes sense. Mm-hmm. So yeah, we are going to take a quick break, and then we are going to come back and dive into Mike's NL auction and hit on the rest of the action that we saw this weekend. So we'll be right back. Welcome back to Flags Fly Forever, Baseball Prospectus Fantasy Podcast. We are continuing our coverage of Tout Wars Weekend, and Now we are going to talk about the fun that Mike had in the NL auction. So I am going to kick it out to him. And Mike, why don't you give us an overview of sort of what you were thinking going into the auction and how it started to materialize for you and how you ended up with the team that you did.
Well, I think we might have talked about this at Foley's the night before. I had decided kind of early on that I either wanted to buy Clayton Kershaw or that I wanted to make somebody pay at least 40 for him. He had gone for 43 in CBSNL, which I was in, and I think Mike Kuchera jumped me from 38, which I had said, to 43, which, you know, it's fine. In labor, which I wasn't in, he went for 40, and, you know, I think that's fair, and I don't think I would have said 41. I just wanted to make sure somebody paid the price. So the way Tout works, the winner from the previous year, who the last 3 years has been Tristan Cockcroft of ESPN. Hi, Tristan, if you're listening. I said to him the night before, I don't know if you were there for this, Brett, I said, I'm going to sit next to you tomorrow, you know, and just make sure to see what you're doing. I didn't mention Kershaw to him. And, you know, Tristan's good-natured. He laughed. And basically, it's something that really allowed me to dictate the tone. And it's a tip I actually picked up from Larry Schechter, who's another very successful player, in his book, Winning Fantasy Baseball. I usually don't call out guys I want, but I decided to do it. And what really worked for me is that Tristan had decided something similar. He called out Max Scherzer with the first call at 30 right off the bat, and nobody said 31. It kind of froze the room. So when I called Kershaw out at 30, I think there was a bit of a hangover, and the only person actively bidding against me was Derek Carty of Fantasy Insiders, and, you know, a former BP guy. And I got Kershaw at 37, and I think a couple people, Derek in particular, was kind of shocked. I could see a look on Derek's face like, oh, man, like, I can't believe I just let that happen.
Yeah, we definitely talked about that. So it was fun to see that in action. But that was not your only big name buy early on in the auction, was it?
No, and, you know, we talked about this too. You know, I kind of was nervous that I was going to get Kershaw and wind up with like one or two big hitters if the room was timid. And I did wind up with one big hitter because the next player called out was Steven Strasburg, and he went for 27 to Scott Wildeman, who also called him out. And I thought, well, that's great because, you know, I want the pitchers, you know, who are the big names to go high. Unfortunately, a lot of the others didn't, but, you know, you can't control everything. And then Eric Young got called out by Phil Hertz, which was just kind of a waste because, you know, he went for the price you think he'd go for, which is like 8. It's kind of hard to make those cute calls in Tout Wars. And then Goldschmidt got called out. And, you know, OBP league bounced back. He went for 38 in labor, which is a batting average league. And, you know, Goldschmidt is worth more in OBP. I think he was worth 46 in OBP in 2013, you know, he was healthy for a full season. Actually, Goldschmidt was a 14th best OBP hitter in the NL with the injury last year. You know, so he good, as people say. So I said 37 thinking he was going to go for 38. But the thing about Tout is it's such a boom, boom auction that I think the people thinking about going for 38 didn't. You know, I talked to Ray Guyfoyle of Fake Teams afterward. He I think was considering it. He had planned not to spend over 30 on a player, which is also why he was out on Kershaw, by the way. Peter Kreutzer, I think, had Goldschmidt at 30 on the sheet, but he didn't want to pay par that early. So when it stopped, I was pretty happy to get Goldschmidt at 37, particularly because, as we've discussed, first base in the NL is really thin this year.
Yeah, I like both of those picks. I think the Goldschmidt buy may have been your best of the whole auction. I am a huge Goldschmidt supporter. I think honestly, right now, given the injury situations of some of the other people in the first round, I think Goldschmidt is. I might take him number two overall in the draft right now behind Tout, behind Trout. Sorry, too much Tout talk. Behind Mike Trout, and especially in an OBP. I mean, we talked about this in the first base segment this year. I think we talked about this in the first base segment last year. I mean, he's just he's just incredibly valuable, and he doesn't seem to quite go for what I think he should go for. Was it NL Labor last year that he went for a ridiculously low price? He went for like $34 or something. He seems to be, I don't remember which auction it was, but he seems to be a guy that there is value opportunity on.
It was NL Labor.
Yeah.
I think it was 34.
Yeah, I think it was Derek Van Riper that
yep.
got him. And I think we talked on the show about how great of a buy that was. And yep. I think it really just sets the tone for the whole offense. He's the first baseman who puts up all your usual first baseman stats, plus he can steal 15 bases.
Yeah, and even if he steals 10, I'd be happy with that.
Even he could steal single digits and still be worth the price that you paid for him.
No, that's absolutely correct. You know, it's funny too because I'm just looking here at last year's numbers. Yeah, last year he went for 33 actually in Labor. In batting average, he earned 24, which made him good for 26th best hitter. And in OBP, he earned, and this is kind of how things go up and down, he earned 27, which made him the 13th best hitter in OBP formats. And that's with 406 at-bats. You know, the guys ahead of him, Anthony Rizzo with 524 at-bats was the next highest number of at-bats. I think that, you know, it's funny, Rizzo went to Tristan Cockcroft, and I believe he went for, you guys probably have the spreadsheet open and I don't, I'm bad here. Yeah, Rizzo went for 31 to Tristan, and Rizzo's worth more in OBP. I just think I like the Goldie buy a little bit better. I understand the $6 gap, but I think Goldie's a guy who could earn over 40. I think Rizzo will have a hard time getting there.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I like Tristan's Rizzo buy as well. I think 31, I think you're right. I think 31 in the OBP league is a really good buy. Not that that should be surprising with Tristan, but you know, there were other first basemen that had more questionable values than those two.
What's funny about Tristan's auction though is that I think, and I noticed, saw this with Larry Schechter last year. I in the past, and this has happened with me too, I think people have kind of just had their own auctions and let Tristan have his auction. This year, and I wasn't even doing it because I spent my money early, there were some people gunning for Tristan, and I think it impacted him a little bit. He had a lot of money left when other people had money. And while I think his team is solid, I think he struggled a little bit more this year than he has in the past. And, you know, struggles relative to Tristan, he still has one of the best teams out there. I just think in past years where he's been the clear favorite, I think this year he's part of what looks like a pretty tight pack.
Yeah, well, you win that many titles in a row and people are going to start bothering you during the draft.
I'm just surprised it happened sooner, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
We've been talking about your two top buys for very good reason. I mean, when you get two big names like Goldschmidt and Kershaw, yeah, it's going to be the main topic of conversation. But I think that it's a little bit misleading because I think that the conclusion that I would draw immediately from hearing that what you did in terms of getting both of those players pretty quick off the draw for you know, large but appropriate numbers is that you went stars and scrubs, and you kind of didn't, really. I think that the rest of your auction filled out in a very interesting manner, you know, especially keeping in mind that this is NL only, and the types of players that you got out of here, you know, this is, you know, I know that you're kind of on the fence about whether or not this is stars and scrubs, but to me, this is not. Like, this is, as Brett kind of alluded to, you know, pre-show, or pre-this segment, this is a little bit modified here. So do you, you want to talk about what you did to fill in the rest of your roster here?
Sure, and you know, I'll kind of go in order. You know, another guy who came up early was Devin Mesoraco, who I got for 17, and I really like Mesoraco. Again, in OBP, he was worth 22 compared to 20 in batting average leagues. I think the average comes down, but he's going to keep walking and unfortunately getting, you know, plunked because that's just the nature of his game. Ben Revere is the other side of this coin, and Revere, I think, based on the room, people absolutely love the buy because Billy Hamilton went for 25. D. Gordon went for 25. I got Revere for 18. Those guys are better, and Revere does take a dive in OBP, but he was worth 23 in OBP formats compared to 30 in NL only. So I felt really good about that. Next up was Lucas Duda. You kind of again back to the OBP swing, $21 player. I thought I might not get him because Brian Walton, I know also of Masters Ball, also likes Duda, and he's the one guy who's taken Duda for me in a real or mock. I've gotten Duda everywhere else this year. But when I said 21, Brian put the brakes on. So, you know, so far, you know, Brett, I think, had mentioned this in the break. You know, we had – I was just going hitter. Then, you know, and we can kind of stop here and talk about another big buy – Carlos Gonzalez for 27. I know some people are a little bit wary of him, but I think if he's healthy when he's on the field, which is the key, you know, people talk about how he's hurt. Last year, he came off the appendicitis. We know that Adam Dunn, the year he had that, came back too fast. I think with Cargo, it was the same thing. He had kind of the weird fatty mass in his hand. These weren't the kind of injuries that, you know, are chronic. These are sort of just those weird one-offs. I think when he's on the field this year, he's had a good spring training. You know, I know some of that's aided by Arizona and the environment there. He earned 30 in OBP in 2013 and 391 at bats. If Cargo misses 30 games, I think he can still return this quite easily.
You know, I agree. We're both pretty high comparatively on Cargo heading into this year. Mostly for the reasons you said. I mean, there's very little. I mean, we know he carries injury risk and he always has, but there's nothing in his 2014 season that I think should make people more concerned for 2015 than they were for 2014. It's sort of the same argument with Tulowitzki that we talked about after labor mixed, which is that, you know, when he plays, he's really good. And there's no reason to think that he'll play in fewer games than he's generally expected to play in, because he had some really strange things happen to him last year.
Well, it's funny because it reminds me of Tulo, you know, a couple of years back, where, you know, Tulo, the last 5 years, he had that one really bad year when he was on the field. I think Cargo is comparable. I'm thinking this is the bad year he had on the field. And if I'm wrong, I'm wrong. But he's a 29-year-old guy. You know, we're not talking about somebody who's like 32, 33, where, you know, the health suddenly falls off the cliff. Go ahead, Mal.
Oh, that was Brett.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Hmm? You were going to say. Good. Oh, well.
Okay, well, then, you know, the next couple hitters that I got were – you know, I'll go out of order here. I got Johnny Peralta at 15, which at this point you'll notice I kind of had catchers and first baseman, and I was getting a little bit nervous about middle and third, and I want at least one guy. You know, Peralta at 15 he's not great, but I thought he was solid at that price. And then the guy we can talk about a little bit, because I know Brett scouted him, you know, in an article for BP, was Yasmani Tomas at 12. I think some people groaned at that pick. You know, right now there's some uncertainty about if he'll even start with the club, but I think at some point he's going to be up. And I think some of his problems this spring is because they're trying to, you know, put a square peg into a round hole at third base. Even if the average isn't there, I think that bat from a power perspective is going to play. And Brett, I'd like for you to talk to this, since you did see him and you did talk to this last week.
Yeah. I wrote up a little bit in our scouting notebook, last week, but you know, Tomas didn't look good, and he hasn't looked good for much of the spring. But there are important factors to note about him. I mean, one he's coming off of a much longer layoff than the hitters around him. Two, he is being asked to play a position that he cannot play. He cannot play third base. He plays third base about as well as Mark Trumbo played third base when the Angels experimented with him for about 5 games in, what, 2012, was it? He does not have really any of the skills for third base outside just pure arm strength. And he's going to play in the outfield, and you know, he's been set back in spring. He's it seems like he's having pitch recognition issues, and you know, some of that could be layoff related. Some of it maybe isn't. Maybe, you know, maybe he just has some pitch recognition issues, but he's got real power. He's got, you know, he's got the kind of power where if he can just scrape by a fringy hit tool, he can hit 30 home runs over the course of a full season. That's probably where he tops out as, but at having a fringy hit tool, and he's, you know, going to take a hit in OBP leagues because he's not gonna walk very much, even in that lineup where there are going to be some weak points where pitchers can kind of work around. But were you going to say, Mike?
I was going to say, it's kind of funny you mentioned that. It's kind of a good segue to later. You know, something I kind of noticed, and this ties into, you know, Mao's point about it being a modified, you know, kind of Stars and Scrubs. I noticed that the team I was starting to put together was definitely not, even though I had Goldie, even though I had Cargo, it was not going to turn into a good, you know, due to two. It was starting to get weak on OBP, so I started focusing on playing time as opposed to OBP, and I'll get into that later, but you'll see that as the composition of the team gets together. So,
yeah.
basically, that's it. You know, it's a pretty strong team elsewhere, but the OBP is weak without a doubt.
Yeah, real quick on Tomas. Someone, and I forget who, I think it was on Twitter, it might have been in a write-up as well, someone hung a Dion Vizcaíno comp on Tomas, and I'm really struggling to fight that comp, actually.
Yeah, our former colleague Jason Collette made that comp in the chat, and again, this is kind of the roto versus real life, too, which is Dion Vizcaíno might be a negative war or a little bit above war, a replacement level. But in terms of fantasy, if Tomas gets the playing time, Brett's right. You know, I think 15 to 20 home runs, even with a slightly negative OBP, plays at the price I got him at.
Yeah, I know Vizcaíno is sort of the lazy comp everyone goes to for the, you know, the fat Cuban guy without much of a hit tool, but you know, when I think about what he could be, I the guy who comes to mind, and it's a weird comparison because he hasn't done it at the major league level, but I think everyone kind of knows what to expect from Michael Franco when he hits the majors and when he kind of reaches his peak. I think Tomas is that kind of hitter. And yeah, it's a better version of Dion Vizcaíno, but it's it's a guy who can make contact. He's not going to, I don't think he's going to be a huge strikeout guy. Once he gets going, he's also not going to be a big walk guy, but he's going to be able to hit home runs. And especially in that ballpark, it's a friendly park for him. It's a good situation, especially because the Diamondbacks have very little organizational depth at outfield.
Well, you know, if there's something that makes me nervous, it's the fact that every day the Diamondbacks seem to change their mind with what they want to do. You know, outside of Goldschmidt taking players from that team just kind of makes you nervous because, you know, it seems like tomorrow they might decide to do something else. But I think overall, you know, I read some crazy report today that said they might send Tomas to the minors all year. That just isn't going to happen. They're just not going to take a guy they spent $68 million on and bury him for a year. I could see them sending him down for like 2 weeks or a month. It just doesn't seem likely that that's going to be the outcome. I mean, for the whole year.
Yeah, I could see a realistic scenario where he's down in the minors and comes up in May.
Yeah, and again, for $12, I didn't pay $18. You know, for $12, that's kind of like, well, you know, whatever. I'd rather him up all year, but I think I can still get the value back at that price.
Yeah. No, it's all a price point, and when people are running away from guys like Tomas, yep, because of something that's happening in spring training, you get values because, you know, they're way, way more often than not, the people who see large valuation swings one way or another in spring training end up completely regressing back to what you thought they were going to do at the beginning of spring training. The you know, the player that has a super hot spring spring training and goes from being a $10 player to a, you know, $15-$17 player is most likely going to be a $10 player.
Yeah, I remember Matt Lindstrom last year, you know, right after the season started, going for like 15 or 17 in AL only auctions.
Don't bring up that.
Oh yeah, closers. I'm sorry, Mel.
No, I'm still shell shocked from that entire thing.
Oh, that's right, Chicago too. It was really bad.
Oh,
sorry.
My god, that was like the worst bullpen I've ever seen in my life. But anyway,
sorry.
But yeah, if you're, I always say this, but if you are drafting at the end of spring training and you can pretty much take anything other than playing time, anything necessary for playing time, and just kind of just zap it from your brain, because it matters less often than it doesn't matter.
Yeah, so we went off on a few tangents there. I'll try to jump back in. So right before the break, the one thing I thought might happen is I thought I might wind up dumping saves, just because the closers, they weren't really going high, but I'd spent a lot of money and I didn't want to get, you know, into a big bidding war. But then the last player I got before the break was Addison Reed at 10, and I was a little bit surprised by that. I'm not in love with Reed, but I think he's going to get the saves, or he's going to give him every attempt to get the saves. I mean, I do like Evan Marshall behind him, but I don't see the Diamondbacks as the kind of team that are just going to give up on Reed, you know, right away. So that was okay. And then I came back with two more pitchers, and you know, there was a point, you know, I know Brett, you and I discussed this, where I was thinking about, you know, just trying to go cheap pitching. But after the hitters that I got and a few other hitters went cheaply early, there were some bidding wars on a few guys. Like I think Jason Hayward went for 26. Matt Kemp went for some kind of crazy price.
He went for 29.
Yeah, it might have been. Yeah, it was 29. There were just a few guys like that. So you kind of get to this point, and I know it sounds weird, even though I'd spent a lot of my money, I don't get cute and pass up on bargains, and I just want to take them where they came. Or I don't want to risk getting into bidding wars for pitchers later, because, yeah, Kershaw's great, but you need guys to surround him with to have a staff. So I got Doug Fister for 13, who you guys know I like. You know, the velocity is low this spring, but that's been true for him in the past. You know, I think he'll be okay. And he's got a nice defense behind him. He's got a nice team behind him. And I got a guy I didn't think I'd get. I got, who I'm a little lower on this year, I got Andrew Cashner at 11, who I think is fine at that price. You know, we know he'll miss a little bit of time. But with the offense that he has now, I think he's going to win more than five games. Here in 12 last year with five wins and about 123 innings. So the floor on him just isn't that low. Then I shifted back to offense. And, you know, I got to say, it's kind of funny. And I think, Mal, this goes back to your point about the modified, you know, stars and scrubs. I got Michael Taylor for 4. This might have been my favorite buy of the draft in terms of low-end buys, because he's their fourth outfielder, but Denard Span is a speedster with a core muscle injury. And I think, you know, I know we have him in labor, Brett, you know, but we took him before the injury. I think for all the talk of his recovery, we don't really know how that's going to affect Span. You've also got Bryce Harper, who, you know, always seems to miss time. You've got Jason Wirth, who's supposed to now be ready on opening day, but I think we'll miss some time here and there. I think even if Taylor is the fourth outfielder, it's not hard to envision 350 plate appearances from him. And, you know, I think even if he hits a little bit, I think I could get back like $10 to $12 of NL-only value there.
Yeah. Yeah. Wirth must have gotten in some extra workouts in jail.
I had the same thought earlier, actually.
I love Jason Wirth. But yeah.
I do too. Yeah. He's just, you know, he's what, 36 years old now?
Yep.
You know, he's just getting up there, and I find the guys that kind of start late sometimes tend to, you know, disappear a little early. The next guy I got, I know some people, it's kind of controversial. In my recap, you know, I'll read it. You know, I got Willian Rosario for 12, and I think I might be his last friend left in the fantasy baseball world. And there's some talk that he won't even start at catcher. But I think it's kind of interesting. If you look at the PFM on him, I think it might be a fairly, you know, I'm not a PFM guy, but it might be fairly accurate. You know, it's talking about 312 plate appearances, but, you know, about 14 home runs and 45 runs batted in. I think that's doable, and I think that might actually be a little bit low, particularly because the Rockies seem pretty committed to him at first base against lefties, and they're even kind of toying with him at a corner outfield. I also think we're talking about Nick Hundley and, you know, Mike McHenry. The obstacles there aren't great. I think if Rosario is on the team, he's going to play enough to get that money back, and he's eligible catcher no matter what the Rocks decide to do with him. Now here came, this kind of put me into cheap territory, and this was the mistake, and not because of what happened later. I got Hyunjin Ryu for 11. Now, this was before the bad injury news with him. The news right before the tout auction was that, you know, his shoulder felt better. He was going to have a catch. But that wasn't the mistake. The mistake was that here, after getting the starters behind Kershaw, I probably should have just let him go for 10 and played the cheaper starter game or shifted some money to offense, because this is where some bargains did come that I missed out on. My team's good enough that if Ryu misses the season, it's not the end of the world. It just would have been a better allocation of money.
Yeah, it's a rough timing blow there. Because I like that price on Ryu when the auction happened, and you know, it is what it is. I mean, you get out of the auction, and when your guys gets hurt, and there's really nothing you can do other than shrug your shoulders.
Yeah. But you know, the thing about Kershaw is, you know, unlike teams I've had in the past, like unlike last year where my frontline guys were Cashner and Tyson Ross, and you know, a couple of years ago I had the cheapo pitching with Matt Latos and, you know, almost nobody, Clayton Kershaw forgives a lot of sins.
Yeah.
You know, so as long as he holds up, and if there's anybody, and you know, there's no such thing as a safe pitcher, but you know, if he holds up, there's a lot of sins that can be forgiven.
I see. Yeah. So, sorry. Go ahead.
Oh no, I was just going to say, especially with ratios, when you kind of combine Kershaw and Fister, I mean, that's about that's a big base that you can kind of take some chances on from there.
What are you going to say, Mal?
You see, you can't quit the Travis Wood thing, huh?
Yeah, we'll get to that. So, he's my Edwin Jackson. I hope, in just in terms of my, you know, love for him and not his performance. Sorry, Brett. Yeah. So at this point, I had $15 left for 9 players, and I think it might have been me and Derek were like the guys that were kind of not in dollar derby, but kind of at the bottom of the barrel. So I also had 5 offensive slots to fill. Now, Tad is a swingman, so it could have been 4, but I wanted the offense. And I think, Mal, this is what we were talking about, how, you know, it could have been a bunch of scrubs, and I think it came out better than it could have. And so I'm not going to run through, you know, every play in great detail. I'll just go through the guys. So I got LaTroy Hawkins for 3. You know, cheapo closer to go with Reed. If he stinks, he stinks. I got Adeni Hechavarria, Yengirvis Solarte, Hechavarria for 2, Solarte for 3, and Freddy Galvis for 1. Two ugly starters in Hechavarria and Galvis, and a guy in Solarte I think will either start or kind of be a super sub. So a lot of potential at-bats there, and with the frontline guys I have, all I need are at-bats. Then, you know, the starters. You mentioned Travis Wood at $1. I got Tim Lincecum at $1. Tout has a liberal reserve rule where you can reserve guys and basically stream them. So Tim Lincecum is going to start for me when the Giants are home. Travis will start when I like the matchups, particularly when it's a lefty heavy lineup. You know, hopefully with the Ryu injury, they won't be pressed in there more, but I think I'm going to be patient. Then I got Noah Syndergaard for 2, and I'm sure, Brett, that you love that price in an NL only.
I do. I'm surprised surprised that price wasn't higher, especially after the Zach Wheeler news.
I said two really fast. I don't know who said one, but I yelled two like when I think I heard the R coming out of that guy's mouth. Because I there were a couple people that had to, and I was sitting on him. Yeah. I missed a couple other guys. Like I missed another guy we like in Anthony DeSclafani. I think Tristan got him for two. And Tristan got somebody I like that I don't think you like as much as I do, Brett and Vance Worley, for two or three. But Syndergaard was really the guy I was waiting on over those guys, which was why I kind of didn't press there or try to outmaneuver.
Yeah, he got the trifecta of guys that we like. He also got Jason Hamill for $6.
Yeah, he did. You know, it's the funny thing about Tristan, and we're not telling much about other people, but he was a champ. After getting Scherzer for 30 and Cueto for 21, he sat back for a long time, and I think his team is kind of similar to mine in that, despite not getting the ace, he did a really good job filling around that ace. I mean, I think the difference obviously is that Max Scherzer, as great as he is and the improvement in the National League, it's more likely that he has kind of that $15 season than Kershaw does, just based on track record, past performance, pedigree, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So just to kind of finish up here, my last two hitters were Kelly Johnson at a buck, who I think can make the team. He's versatile. Let's try that again. Peter Bourgeois at one, who even if he doesn't start, I think could be cheap speed. And then the reserves, I know one of these guys, Mao's going to love. Addison Russell, who I think if Chris Liss had been in the room of RotoWire, probably went for three or four, but I got him just as a stash. Tyler Matzek, who's another nice potential stream on the road. Matt Reynolds, who honestly, if the Daniel Murphy injury is nothing, I'm going to cut right away. And Neil Ramirez, who I think is a nice relief guy to kind of put in there when some of those streamer starters I mentioned, I don't want to start them. So, overall, I want to get your thoughts, but I think overall you guys are right. I think that I know people say this, but you guys, I'm a little more cautious about this than others. I really like this team. I think it's a pretty solid group overall.
I agree. There are a lot of things that I like about the team, and I'll tell you the one thing that I think I like best, and you touched on it before, is that you in these leagues you get into situations where the guys you pick up for $1 to $3 towards the end are a little rough around the edges and really don't have the potential to return much value. But I maybe it's because I just like some of these same guys that you do, but there's some guys who could potentially earn double digits that you got very cheaply. I mean, the one guy who I might like the most is Solarte. I mean, Will Middlebrooks is pretty terrible, and I think it's very reasonable. Essentially, the entire Padres infield is terrible. I could absolutely see a scenario where Solarte gets 450 at bats this year. At a combination of positions, and then gets additional eligibility. Maybe he's, maybe he gets middle infield eligibility. You never know with him. And Borges, we've talked about in the past. But if you're going to spend on a dollar, if you're going to spend a dollar on a guy, you might as well spend a dollar on a guy who's earned, I think, $15 to $20 in the past, and now claims that he's healthy again. So there are worse guys to spend a dollar on, but the staff I think has some potential. I think the beginning of the season might be a little rough, just because Ryu obviously is going to go on the DL and Syndergaard's going to start in the minors. But I think Ramirez is a really nice pick to fill in there, and then there should be other players available in a relief role that you can plug in at least for a couple weeks at the beginning, and then kind of feel out the rest of the staff.
Yeah, you know, the difference, you know, to your point, you know, to look at last year and just kind of throw out some guys that I got, I think that last year I didn't spend over 30 on a player, and I had a core of like David Wright at 29, Justin Upton at 28, Billy Hamilton at 22, and Matt Kemp at 21. With the exception of Wright, those guys were all fine, but the problem was none of them were big-time performers, you know, at the top. Like, I think Goldschmidt should be, and like Cargo could be. And then the problem was is that I got guys like, you know, Gabby Sanchez at 7, Zach Cozart for 8, I got Berjos for 6, I got Casey McGee for 3, and he worked out great. But the problem is, you know, it's sort of that whole idea, like, why spend 7 or 8 on guys like that when I can spend 1 or 2? And I think that's the idea. I think the idea is instead of spending that money where it's like, oh, great, you know, I got Gabby Sanchez for 7. Maybe he'll earn 7. You know, it's like, oh, you know, I got Freddie Galvis for 1. You know, maybe he'll earn, you know, maybe he'll hit those 10 home runs like some people think he will and earn 6 or 7. But if he doesn't, I got him for 1. You know, it doesn't matter that much. And I'm kind of ensuring that the production I'm getting is going to be from the top guys. And obviously, the drawback to this is that if Goldie doesn't perform, you know, it's always the if, you know, if some of these top guys don't perform, I'm out of luck. But I'd kind of rather go that way. And the other thing I'll point out, which is really interesting and is very atypical for a Mike Gianella auction, this is a young team. It's a sweet spot of guys kind of between the ages of 26 to 29. You know, LaTroy obviously is an old man, but, you know, beyond that, you've got Johnny Peralta. I'm looking at guys over 30. I think on offense, I got Kelly Johnson and Johnny Peralta at 33, and that's it. And you know, I haven't had the ages in front of me from the Pecota. And then on the pitching side, I got Pfister and Lincecum at 31 and LaTroy at 42. This is a young team.
Yeah, and the, you know, that point about last year is a really good one. We just sort of looking across at different corner infielders that went in that sort of $6 to $9 range. You have Jake Lamb, who's another guy who's getting some spring hype, but I don't think Lamb is any better of a bet to either get playing time or produce than Solarte is. And same with Michael Franco, same with Darren Ruff. I mean, if you're not spending $10 to $15 at that position, yeah, spending, you know, 1 to 3 makes a whole lot of sense.
Yeah, I mean, even some of the third basemen, you know, like Chris Johnson, you know, like Juan Uribe, who, you know, there's some talk now that, you know, either the, you know, Dodgers are going to bring in Oliveira or that Alex Guerrero could possibly steal some, if not a lot, of those at-bats. There, you know, Cody Ash is another one who's kind of a risk at some point, you know, perhaps because of Michael Franco, who you mentioned earlier. I think all these guys, you know, we're all optimistic in March about these like guys. And honestly, there's always a lot of $6 to $9 guys who are just going to flame out. It happens every year. We can't see who they are now, but it's going to happen.
Yeah. And yeah, there are other buys like that. And Steve Gardner got Justin Turner for $2.
Yeah.
Which is great. Yep. I'd rather have Turner than a couple of those guys that went for $6 at a similar price.
It's funny because you know, I never do this. I don't do this because, you know, projection systems, as we know, are kind of crummy. And Tristan's projection system for the ESPN one had me winning the league, albeit barely, and he was surprised by that because the whole adage is if your projection system doesn't project you to win, then, you know, you did something wrong. So I ran the PFM, which, as you guys know, I don't use the PFM for my auctions just because I don't go off that, I go off my own bids. And it's hilarious because the PFM has me winning, like, going away. I think it has me winning by like 23 points or something like that, which I'm not saying that to brag. I'm just kind of saying in this way that it's kind of a sign that you had a good auction when, you know, something has you winning going. It doesn't mean I think I'll win. No, but it means that, you know, it's kind of something that's a little more mechanical than I am looks at it. And it's like, yeah, there's some some potential upside here. Actually, the whole reason I brought that up is because the PFM doesn't like Gardner's offense. And it's one place where I kind of disagree. I look at Steve Gardner's offense and I'm like, yeah, I think for the most part, there's a lot to like here. The one thing I don't like is Jason Wirth at 20 and Hunter Pence at 18. Like, it's a combined 38 for guys that, we know one guy is going to miss a whole month and another guy is, going to start out perhaps a little bit rusty, even if he does make the roster to start.
Yeah, there's a lot of upside on Steve's roster.
Yeah. I mean, Matt Harvey for 19 that's what I wanted to mention with Kershaw. As much as I like the Kershaw buy, it is where you get stuck. And Steve and I talked about this afterward. As much as I like the price and force, I couldn't sit there on Wainwright's another one. I know you like Wainwright, Brett, and I think Adam Wainwright at 18 is a really good price. But, I couldn't sit there all day and be like, oh, that's good, I'm going to buy, because, I would have wound up with a $120 pitching staff and a sad face at the end of the day.
Yeah, Wainwright at $18 is insane.
Yeah.
That might be the one number that jumps out to me more than anyone else in the entire draft. I mean, he went just eyeballing it, he looks like he was the maybe 12th most expensive pitcher in NL.
Well, and it's funny because this is where it's hard to see unless you're there or watching it. So, there's always seams, and, there were seams where like Harvey and John Lester at 19 and a couple guys came out, and there were seams the other way where Gerrit Cole, I know we like him, but he went for 20 and that was kind of aggressive and it was a bidding war. Lance Lynn went to Ray Guyfull of fake teams at 16. That was like another bidding war. You could just kind of see where the seams were and where people were fighting for guys. Matt Latos at 15, I think, was another one of those seams where people were just aggressive on pitchers. And, the key was just kind of jumping in at the right time. That was the one thing because of Kershaw that I couldn't do. I had to sit back and be conservative and not really, go big on another pitcher. Well, it's funny, we've talked about this before. The failure rate for pitchers typically is in that 15 to 20 range. So as much as we say some of these prices are great, some of these guys will fail. Of course, it's more likely that Lance Lynn or Julio Teheran are going to be the failures, not Adam Wainwright and Matt Harvey.
Yeah. Agreed. Any other final thoughts on NL before we kind of jump around a little bit?
The one final thought I have is that I, usually, and this is where I think this worked to my advantage, usually tout is a little bit more aggressive than labor. I think this year in some ways was a little bit more conservative, and I think that's what worked to my advantage, and it kind of allowed me to kind of find those places in the auction where I was going to be able to get the guys I needed. And the thing with Galvis and Hecheverria is that I was really planning from early on to make sure I tried to get everyday players, no matter how bad they looked on paper. And, that is one thing I do agree with PFM projections. It's just I kind of bagged on base percentage, but I kind of did that last year because there's still enough variability in it that even though I have like a team that projects out to like a 2-point team and on base, I could get 4 or 5 points depending on how, the category actually goes.
Sounds good. So another team that we will be tracking over the course of the season.
Yep.
Mike, you were in the room for, I believe, a good portion of the AL draft as well. So as we sort of transition from the leagues that we participated into the leagues that we, just sort of watched from the sidelines, what jumped out at you in the AL in terms of just overall strategies or designs and or valuations?
Well, I mentioned him before, but Larry Schechter is a damn good player, and every year he manages to put together a team that I just don't know how he does it, but he gets these boring guys like Omar Infante at 6 and Logan Morrison at 4, and all these players where he just manages to, James Loney at 8 is another one I like, Evan Gattis at 18 in an OBP league. He just stacks his team with value. That's the first thing that jumps out at me. I think on a larger level, I kind of look at the league, and it's the NL is, as I say this every year, the NL tout is harder to predict because there's only three overlap guys from NL labor. AL tout has more overlap than AL labor, so that there's just really, you kind of almost know where guys are going to go and what's going to happen. Like, you know that Glenn Colton and Rick Wolf are going to buy Robinson Cano, and they got him this year for 30. Like, you know they're going to get or go after Mike Trout, and they got him for 46. There's just patterns that kind of happen every year in this league. There's the same guys bidding on players. It's almost like you get to watch a little play. You know, the one thing that surprised me a little bit of overlap is Chris List from RotoWire. He sat back in labor and really bought guys late. Here, he was jumping in guys in an attempt not to do that, and he went over a couple guys, but he got Evan Longoria at 22, which surprised me a little bit, and he got a couple other players that I think really fell into the bargain bin for him because he was doing that and because people didn't want to like push him.
Yeah, there were a couple of buys of his that I thought were really, really interesting. Two of them right next to each other. Looking at his outfield, he's got Byron Buxton for $4 and Anthony Ghost for $4. Buxton, were you in the room when he came out? Was that?
Yeah, I think Buxton came out for one, and somebody said three, and then Chris said four. I think, yeah. Chris might have called Buxton out. I'd have to go back and look. But, you know, Chris's MO is often to call out, like, rookies like Buxton. And, you know, honestly, it's like some people didn't like the play or some people said, well, you know, Buxton won't be up this year. That's a waste of money. But a lot of that's environmental. You know, go back to what I did in the NL. You know, I was able to get Russell and nobody really made a play for him. And I got Syndergaard for two. In the AL, I think people were a little bit more aggressive with some of those like young players, and you know they were kind of called out more. So I'm not necessarily against that. It could be a waste of money, but again, the reserve rules are liberal, so he could always stash Buxton and leave him down there for as long as he wants.
That's true. And then Ghost for $4, I thought was exactly the opposite. I thought that was a great buy.
Yeah, me too.
I mean, he's an OBP suckhole, but he's an OBP suckhole who could steal 25 to 30 bases.
Yeah, well, and in particular, a lot of the part-time or quasi-part-time players who steal bases weren't cheap. You know, I think Jared Dyson went for 11 to Jason Collette. I think Raj Davis went to Ron Chandler for 12. You know, I know Raj Davis always returns a lot of value, but with Goes in the picture this year, he might lose some time. You know, I think Larry Schechter had the other, you know, steal buy I liked, and Jordan Schaefer at three. Steals seem to be in all the mono leagues. They really seem to be at more of a premium now, and it's harder to find that guy on the bench, which you think would be the opposite given the depressed offensive context, but it's harder to find that guy on the bench of a major league team who's just a speed guy.
Yeah. Where have you gone, Tony Campana?
Yeah, really.
Well, his career is probably unfortunately done.
People were talking about you know, the designated pinch runner who was like the track star. I think it was Herm Washington for like the 70s A's. He came up after Tout AL.
Yeah.
About how fast he was, but you know, how just he wasn't a base runner at all.
I think he had like what, 30 stolen bases and no plate appearances or something,
yeah,
something like that.
Yeah, and I think he got caught stealing like 17 times.
Yeah, it's something like that.
Yeah,
I'd have to look at it, but I think he was a pretty poor base stealer, even though he was one of the fastest people on the planet.
You know, another point about Tout AL is that I think, unlike the NL, where like, and this happened last year too. This is the second year we used on base. It had been experimented with in the mixed. Unlike the NL, where it didn't push the prices up as much. And I think some of that, you know, Joey Votto, who we didn't talk about, was hurt, so he didn't get the full, like, bump up this year. And Shin-Soo Choo is no longer in the National League. You saw the bump a little bit more in the American League. But on the other hand, I think people were more conservative. Last year, Trout went for 49. This year, he went for 46. I think people are recognizing that even though on base is a little bit steadier than batting average, it's still not a category that you should pay the full price for. Mike Podhorzer of Fangraphs was the guy last year who kind of completely paid the OBP freight. He did it for Jose Bautista this year at 37, although that's not quite the full OBP freight. I think otherwise he kind of laid off of that a little bit. He insists in his column that he didn't do that with Prince Fielder, so I'll have to take him at his word. He paid 28 for him. You know, Mike's team is funny because it sort of has some of the Stars and Scrubs thing I did, although, you know, some of his buys I don't like quite as much. And I think some of it, you know, he paid 24 for Mookie Betts. And, you know, I hate to keep slamming Mike or mentioning this every time, you know, we talk about Mike and Betts, but Betts has to do so much to, like, get to the prices that Mike is paying for him, like, in various, like, formats.
He looks good, though.
He does. I know. And, you know, Eric Carabel of ESPN, like, has been raving about Betts as well. And I have Betts in a home league for 10, so I hope I'm wrong. But it's just such a – it's such an aggressive price to pay for a guy like Betts.
Yeah. I mean, it's – well, it's still less than the Brett Laurie price, right?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, and you know, it's kind of funny, too, because at the very least, I think that – it's always a thing with prices. Like George Springer went for 28. I think a lot of people, and you know, include me in this, like I really like Springer, but Springer had a great month last year. He didn't, you know, after that, I know Grant somebody was hurt, but he hasn't done, you know, Jason Kipnis is another one. You know, Kipnis went for 24, and you know, coming in, he's got that back injury, and now after the fact it looks like that might be bothering him. But the thing with Kipnis for me is he hasn't hit for power now in a year and a half, and it's kind of the elephant in the room. Everybody's like, he's going to bounce back, and I think we all have our guys, and we kind of all chase them to, like, prices. So, you know, it's always going to be something. I think it's always the nature of analyzing these auctions. Like, we all have, you know, things we like, things we don't like, and I'm sure everybody in this auction looks at the team they bought, and for the most part, with the exception of one or two guys, they like the prices they paid.
Yeah, that's the beauty of it.
Yeah, and, you know, somebody's going to be right. And, you know, what's always funny is, you know, somebody's going to be right and there's going to be a guy they bought that they were kind of lukewarm on that probably makes a big difference to their season.
Yeah. All right. So I think we both weren't quite around the mixed auction very much, but I didn't know whether you had any general thoughts on that. I mean, I was participating in mine while that was going on, so yeah. I saw very little of it, but it seemed to be relatively straightforward.
Yeah, there was nobody left like $60-whatever on the table, and I think, you know, Scott Swanee, who was the one who did that, I think he made that joke at some point, you know, during the auction. You know, I think he said Brandon Beachy for 69 or whatever the amount was. I don't think it was actually 69. I'm being a bit of a wise ass, but the thing about mix, and just to make a general point about philosophy, is that in theory in mix you should actually pay more for the top guys than you do for the guys and only because of the whole replacement level concept. And it's the whole idea that, you know, that there's a replacement for your bottom level shortstop. You know, if even in a 15 team mixed, if your bottom of the barrel guy is Didi Gregorius, you can find somebody out in the free agent pool who's a reasonable facsimile and might even be better. Or Ryan Howard's example, he went for a buck in the mixed, and you know, you can probably find a Ryan Howard type out in the free agent pool if Ryan Howard washes out, whereas you're not going to find a Mike Trout in the free agent pool, so you used to pay more. But I think in this environment, people kind of do that to a point, but they don't take it all the way. And, you know, the surprise for me was Kershaw going for less, $4 or $1 less in the mix than I bought him for in the NL. Like, I know that there's a lot of pitching in a 15-team mix, but I think had I been in that room, I would have at least pushed him to 40 just because there is no other Clayton Kershaw. And because if Clayton Kershaw does get hurt in the mixed, that the replacement level guy is not going to be a complete zero.
Well, I mean, we know from last year how it was to replace an ace in a 15-team mixed. And there are guys out there, but it can be tough sledding.
Sure, but you know, I guess the comparison to an NL only is that you know the guy to replace him is nothing, you know, or it's you know it's Travis Wood who I happen to purchase, but you know, or David Buchanan. I think right now in the NL only might be the best pitcher out there, and no, I'm not kidding. If you don't play NL only and you're listening to this,
yeah, that's true. But it's not like a it's not like a 12 team mixed where
no, it's and that's a fair point. But I guess, you know, the idea is just looking at the pool, you know, I'm surprised, for example, that Kershaw went for, you know, it's just kind of funny. The separation between Kershaw and Strasburg in a 15-team mixed was $8. And in the NL auction, it was $10. Like, it's just, it's a little alien to me, I guess.
Yeah.
But, you know, as far as, like, things that jumped out, like you said, it's kind of hard because I was drifting in and out. I wanted to watch you and see how you were doing. I wanted to interact with you. You didn't really know a lot of the people in, you know, Tout X. And, you know, you seemed to, like, be doing fine with them. But, you know, I just wanted to see how you were doing. So I didn't really spend a lot of time analyzing this or looking at this. I do think that mixed auction, my general observation, and I don't know, Mao, if you do any mixed auctions or not, or if you do, Brett, but it does seem that sometimes there's no rhyme or reason. There's like there's a discipline, a rhythm to monoleague auctions, mixed auctions sometimes, because there's so many different and diverging philosophies. It seems even less about value than an NL is, like there, or an AL. Like, it seems like there's some people in our AL that are like me, who are value oriented, and others like, I want to get the player I want to get. And that there's a cost in an only league to not following value. In a mix, there's less of that cost because of the replacement player that I mentioned. And as a result, I think the prices you see are very divergent. And I honestly think that's why mixed pricing, I get a lot of questions about it, you know, with the updates I put out, and we'll see one this Thursday. I think mixed pricing is really hard to get a beat on.
Yeah, there's definitely more gaps, but that is, I noticed that in leagues that I do as well. You know, if you're the more disciplined you are, the better values you get in a mixed league than you do in a mono league. But yeah, that is exactly what you would expect. So I guess that's it. I think we've covered everything now. So it was a very fun weekend. We got to catch up with friends of the podcast. Actually, pretty much every friend of the podcast we've had was there, and we got to see Corey Schwartz, who was our first guest on this podcast over a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
We got to see Steve Gardner. We got to see Scott Pienowski. We got to see Peter Kreutzer. Obviously, he's one of the leaders of the Tout Ring. But it's always good to see people and put faces to names again, even if we generally only see these people more or less once or twice a year.
Yeah, and it's New York City, which is always a great time.
Yep. Yes, it is. So that concludes our broadcast day. So we'll take a quick break, and we'll close up shop. Welcome back. Flags Fly Forever, episode 47. We are a baseball prospectus fantasy podcast, and we are now over. I implore you to read all of us at baseballprospectus.com. We are obviously done with our positional series that we wrapped up earlier in March, but we are continuing our fantasy coverage through everyone's drafts. and we are going to be providing the type of coverage that you've come to expect from Baseball Prospectus in season, with hopefully some additional fun things to roll out over the course of the coming months. Go to BP today, sign up for a premium membership, and you get access to all of it, all of our fantasy stuff, all of our prospect stuff, all of our general awesome writing stuff by other people who don't fall into one of those two buckets. And if you get a super premium membership, you get access to the Bat Signal, which is our fantasy answering service. You ask us a question, we get back to you generally within about 12 hours. People seem to like it, and Craig seems to hate it. So that's more reason that you should do it. Again, you can reach us, Flags Fly Forever, at baseballperspectus.com. With that, we are out. We will see you next week for our last preseason show of the year. Then it's regular season all the way, baby.
It's all happening.
Absolutely. Yeah. One more episode to go before we will be watching live regular season baseball on our TVs while it is going on. Man. And we will see you next week. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye. So,